Hello, my name is Tristan Nieslein, and you're listening to The 3 E's, an Extreme E podcast. In this episode, I speak with Dr. Lucy Woodall, Extreme E's ocean scientist. Lucy is currently an associate professor at the University of Oxford, scientific associate with the Natural History Museum in the UK, as well as the science director for the Necton Foundation, a link to who you can find in this show's notes. As a marine biologist, Lucy was very involved with the recent Ocean Exprès in Senegal and why projects focused on marine health were important in Extreme E's calendar of events. As Lucy has also pioneered research into the consequences of marine litter and the effects of microplastics in the deep sea, we talk about the health of the oceans and a lot more besides. I hope you enjoy our conversation. This is the 3 E's. I am joined today by Dr. Lucy Woodall. Hi, Lucy.
Hello, good to meet you.
And you. It's great to have you on the podcast today, particularly to talk about the key areas of your research around ocean health, but also, as we're an Extreme E podcast, a little bit of what you were doing with Extreme E and how that came to be. Let's start with a bit of background. So how did you become a marine biologist, and what kind of advice would you give somebody who would like to get into that area of work?
So I must say I didn't have the most obvious pathway into doing what I do now. I guess I started because I was fortunate enough to live by the ocean, and I used to spend my summers rock pooling. So I always wanted to know what everything was that we found. And starfish didn't cut it when I saw two starfish that looked different. You know, they had to have different names. So I'm sure that was very frustrating for my parents and grandparents. So I would say that maybe I started with being really curious about the world. Started being curious about marine world, but also about the butterflies and bees and insects and plants that were around me as well. I think also growing up by the coast, I had this connection to the ocean. And I understood its importance to coastal communities. So it wasn't just the life in it and enjoy being on it or swimming around in it myself, but it was understanding the heritage of communities, the way that villages and hamlets and indeed towns have grown up around our coastlines because of the value of the ocean. And for me, it's kind of these two things that always sat with me. Well, I did a degree because I love biology. And I also wanted to be a marine biologist, but didn't quite know which area of marine biology was for me. So I spent some time outside of academia. And then when I came back in, I was very focused and I really knew what I wanted to do. And that was to absolutely investigate the marine environment some more, but to do so with the aim of providing more information around conservation and management. So I guess I'm interested in the so what question. I'm interested in the patterns I see and what animals we find in the ocean, but I want to know why they're there. And our generations in the future are going to be seeing them in the same place. And I think that for me is still that curiosity, making sure that there's a use for the information that myself and the awesome team around me are discovering.
Fantastic. I think that leads us really nicely onto actually the context of marine biology and the oceans, indeed, to our day-to-day lives. So how would you kind of characterize that?
Yeah, this context, I think, is really important. So I think the ocean being really vast, but interconnected. So this means something that I do in the UK has impacts on other humans, other forms of life, and other processes many, many miles away. And that is kind of hard to get your head around sometimes, just that vastness, but also the interconnectedness of the ocean. So we know that the ocean is full of diverse life, and we might have seen maybe documentaries on the TV and seen sort of some of the crazy fish from depth. We might have gone and gone swimming or rock pooling like I've been able to do and see some of the shallows. But what we might not know is that we've only discovered just a real small proportion of the diversity and been able to give them names. So when we're talking about the ocean, we are only kind of looking through a tiny slit, because that's the only information we've got available to us. So trying to interpret this massive 3D space is pretty tough. And I think the other aspect that we maybe don't get as humans is that we look at the surface of the water the majority of time. You know, we can snorkel and we can scuba dive, but we mostly look at this flat surface. Sometimes it's a bit lumpy if it's a windy day. But that flat surface hides the valleys and the mountains that comprise the seabed, which is as diverse as we can see on land. And actually, a lot of my time as a scientist has been exploring this world, and especially these submarine mountains, and we call these seamounts. So as scientists, we say that the ocean provides us with services, and these are services to humankind and indeed the rest of the planet as well. But in reality, these services just mean that we derive benefit from the ocean. And these benefits are so diverse. So I just thought to help with the understanding of this diversity, I could just share a few. So these sort of range from maybe the ocean acting like a sponge for carbon dioxide, and also for the way that it transports heat and nutrients across the planet. Our ocean and indeed our terrestrial world would look very different if we didn't have this transportation via the ocean. Indeed, here in the UK, that's what keeps the UK warm. It's the Gulf Stream coming up, those warm waters. Of course, many of us know that the marine world is a vital source of protein for many, but maybe something that we haven't considered is that often the communities that eat seafood for their protein don't have any other option. So I think it's something for us to consider when we're thinking about the ocean, that in fact, all of us have really different experiences. And of course, I can talk for myself when I say that I actually enjoy being in the blue space, and that intrinsic benefit and that smile that I get on my face when I see a whale, a dolphin, or even just some little sea slug, little nudibranchs. I can see them in the rock pools, and I absolutely love finding them. Amazing colors, and such a treat when we do find them. So that's lots of benefits. And of course, as a marine biologist and as an ocean lover, I could just go on for days.
Please do. I think that importance is, it's clearly overlooked sometimes, you know, in terms of the connection between the oceans and the rest of our kind of biological infrastructure of the planet. It's hard to make those connections sometimes. So what are some of the key findings that you've actually observed in your work relating to particularly oceans and climate change and that interlinking of the two?
Yeah, so I don't think we can think about the oceans and the atmosphere without thinking about the consequences, and really, I would say, the climate change crisis. It's something that is impacting people now, both in tropical areas and in polar regions. And in fact, just this week on the west coast of North America, we're seeing massive heat waves. And this is down to the consequences of climate change. Mm. When we think about the ocean, there's many different consequences. We're thinking about temperature increases. We're thinking about deoxygenation. We're thinking about increased acidification. But it's sometimes not obvious. If you haven't gone back and seen things time after time, to really notice these differences. So I think a really good way in is to think about some of the other impacts and stresses on the ocean. And these are things like pollution and microplastics. It's become a lot more in the media and sort of in the public facing interest. And we know pollution comes in many, many forms, and most we can't see, but littering of solid objects we can. And a lot of the solid objects that we find as pollution in the ocean are things that we have all bought or consumed or at least seen in a store at some time. So it makes it really obvious. And this direct connection to a stressor on our ocean, I think, is actually really powerful. So I started to research this topic when I saw increasing beach litter. In fact, I later saw litter in really remote places on the seabed, so thousands of meters deep in the Southern Ocean. And to give you context on this, this is about 5 days away from any land on the ship we're on. So middle of the Southern Ocean, just before we get to Antarctica, really probably the last place on the planet that you would expect to see trash. And we did. So later on, I went to investigate really the sources of this litter and to try and understand from other locations how to predict the amount of litter that we see on the seafloor. And this is where this term seamount comes back in. Remember those mountains under the ocean? So the work that I did was in the Indian Ocean and Atlantic Oceans. And on seamounts in those two oceans, and that's, to give you a context, about 1% of the seafloor, we estimated there was between 32 and 38 million items. So I'm just going to leave that with you to sink in. We're not talking about a little bit here and there. We're talking about a lot. And it wouldn't be there if it wasn't for humans. It's absolutely human made. So we need to really think about turning off that tap and stopping anything else from getting in to the ocean, because this is an additional stressor for our systems and the organisms that live in it.
That's just an incredible number. And yeah, it's great to let it stay there. So that was 38 million pieces of trash were estimated in around 1% of the ocean's floor. Was that
1% of the ocean of the Indian and Atlantic Oceans?
Of the Indian,
so it's not even the entire ocean.
So multiply that by two other massive oceans that are bigger, and by 100%. Again, and you will not even come close to the amount of trash, because then you have some that's washed up, you have some that ends up in marine life, and then you have a little bit, I guess, that has started to be cleaned up by ocean cleanup projects and what have you. So that's not even the final number, is it? That's just what hasn't been otherwise seen, and that's an incredible number. So not to state the obvious, but that amount of trash, like, how do you begin to quantify the impact of that then on ocean health and planetary health?
Well, it's definitely challenging. Let's put it out there, right? You know, and I guess if it wasn't challenging, I wouldn't really have a job. So, you know, it's not going to be answered tomorrow, and it's not going to be answered by me as an individual. You know, this is very much thinking about how do we work together, multiple disciplines, people from outside of science, working with scientists, to really think about what do we need to know, what are the critical points. So what we know certainly about our pollution is the thing we need to do is stop putting into the ocean. It's incredibly hard to clean up. And there's no proven way of cleaning up the ocean without also being detrimental to the animals and plants that are living in the ocean. So let's stop it from getting in the first place. We now, across the globe, have a lot of different surveys to really understand what's happening. And these are important for us to understand what's happening over time, because often it's little changes here and there. Is it a little getting better or a little, and actually it's getting worse? And until you look at something for 10, 15 years, then sometimes these are not evident. You're right, we've got lots of different sources of plastic, most of them from the land, but we've also got lots of different sinks. So the deep sea, and my work there has shown that indeed the deep sea is a sink for not just large pieces of plastic, but also microplastics, the small fragments of plastic. But we have sinks, in organisms. We have sinks potentially in the atmosphere, in the water column itself. And we haven't even started to understand the enormity of the pollutant in those areas. Now, this might sound all doom and gloom, and I guess in some ways it is. But actually, there's a good message here. These plastics have only come from the consequences of human actions. So as humans, we have absolutely 100% control in not producing any more or not allowing leakage of any more of these into our environments. So this is going to come with innovation. This is going to be the challenge of us changing our behaviors, and also really asking ourselves, what do we value? You know, do we need some single use bit of plastic that we're going to use for 5 minutes, or maybe we don't need it at all, or we could use a degradable material instead? And the answer to that is going to be different for everything. You know, it's unlikely we'll get away from plastics entirely, because they are massively versatile and incredibly useful and vital in a lot of industries. You know, I think about their applications in medicine, but actually there's a lot of times that we don't really need to use plastic. And if each of us think about that, that's really helpful, alongside having alternatives that, of course, are going to have to be innovative new solutions to some of these challenges. So combined effect, but I think we can get there.
Yeah. And again, a lot of the choices that we make day to day aren't necessarily in those kind of industries that are, you know, rely on plastics really heavily. It's for something that actually the technology and the approach does exist to perhaps use something different. If it's grabbing a drink or a packaged material of some kind, you can actually start making those choices now, which I agree. I think it's certainly in control, and there's definitely a positive change happening right now, and we can see that, I guess, with the impact of, again, sports like Extreme E popping up and wanting to promote that message. In the last race in Senegal, I mentioned it before, this graphic around sea level rise that kind of came out, which I was fascinated by, and to see the impact of the next location in terms of Greenland, and kind of the impact of climate change on oceans in that respect, as glacial melt then creates sea level rise. Presumably there's going to be, you know, much wider impacts from the oceans on climate change also.
The tipping points are actually the point of no return. So in reality, and I guess in some ways most worrying, we don't really know when these are going to happen until they do. So of course, there's lots of really great modeling, and lots of people have spent a huge amount of time and brain power doing this. But again, there's no guarantee until it actually happens. So when we think about tipping points, there's quite a lot regarding climate change. And I just thought I would share one with you right now that is to do with some of the areas that my personal research looks at. And this is around coral reefs. So all organisms have an optimum temperature in which they live, as humans, we're no different. You know, we've evolved mechanisms like heating and clothing and aircon to keep us warmer or colder. But actually, we have an optimum temperature. And most organisms are more vulnerable to warming than they are to slightly cooling. In the ocean, this is really clear with coral reefs. And this phenomenon we call bleaching. So bleaching happens, and that's sort of the whiteness of corals that you can sometimes see in tropical reef systems. So this happens due to the expulsion of this little symbiotic organism called a dinoflagellate. All this means is that the coral provides some benefit for this little dinoflagellate, and it provides benefits for the coral. Now, the benefit it provides for the coral is it's some of its energy. Okay, some of the coral energy comes from these dinoflagellates. But when it gets too warm, the coral gets stressed and they expel them. Now, without these dinoflagellates, which get their energy from the sun through photosynthesis, so kind of like plants, there's not enough nutrients in the water to sustain the corals. So therefore, they end up not having much nutrients. And if the water temperature stays warm, then they don't have the dinoflagellates again, and then they end up dying. So that in itself is pretty devastating for coral and coral reefs. But actually them as we call them ecosystem engineers, but it just means that they're really important for lots of other things that live in and around them. Because they're important for juvenile fish as nurseries. And these are some of the fish that, you know, are used in fisheries. So hence actually really important for humans. There's also the protection of corals for the shoreline. So if you see a big storm, a lot of the energy in those waves gets dissipated by coral reefs on the shore. So of course, then this means that no coral reefs means it's devastating for the entire community. And unfortunately, studies have shown that there's a really high likelihood that poor coral reefs could disappear with just a 1.5 degree rise in ocean temperatures. And of course, this is only one example. So this is not 100 years down the line. This is something that we have to act on now.
Mm. If we take that example a little bit further, what is the outlook for the ocean and for this kind of coral issue if left unchecked right now?
Yeah, so I think it is something that we do need to consider, because I've only described one consequence, and 1.5 degrees isn't that much. Mm. So we have to take it seriously. We have to act now. We can't leave it to others. And in fact, just one step further along this path of temperature increase means that we've both got less time to change it around, but we've also got more work to do. So we do have to shift this trajectory. So some of the actions that we need to take immediately probably aren't a surprise. We absolutely need to decrease our greenhouse emissions and take that as close to zero as we can. But alongside those decreases in emissions, we need to also think about where we can have an increased uptake in carbon. And in a way that is really supportive of our biological systems and our biological diversity. Actions are required in both areas for us to be able to move forward. And when I talk about increasing uptake of carbon, I'm thinking like tree planting or mangrove planting. But this isn't planting one species and that's going to be fine. It's really understanding what the nature, what those environments need, and planting things that are native, planting a mixture of species, so that not only do we have a great uptake of carbon, but also that it protects the environment for the future, increasing resilience, and provides a unique environment for organisms into the future. So we need to think about this, but I think also a point is kind of coming back to our work on plastics. There are other stresses that we also need to really minimize. So pollution is one, but we also need to think really carefully around this, some destructive practices of overfishing or some types of fishing gear, because in the ocean, that is a big cause for stress in many areas. So as you can see, really, there are some things we need to do directly for the climate, but it's never one issue is going to be that magic bullet. It's going to be a complex suite of solutions that need to address both climate change, but also biodiversity crisis.
Yeah, and just like our world is complex and has all of these different strands and strains to it, so all the solutions have to come back those same routes, I suppose, and look at things in that same kind of complexity. You can't just kind of flick one switch and then all of those threads are resolved.
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, you know, it's not just our biological systems and our climate systems, it's also our communities. Mm. We need to make sure that any interventions that we put into place are appropriate for those local communities where those impacts are greatest. So, I mean, it really is a real interesting but complex challenge, which again is why we need these real thought leaders from across multiple different disciplines to come together and to really listen to each other, and not just experts because they happen to have letters after their name, but experts in their own communities. So these are local leaders, people who have lived in a particular location for generations. It's this local and indigenous knowledge that has to be inputted into our understanding to make sure we can find appropriate solutions.
I know this is a little bit also a focus of your research, and maybe it answers the next question as well, but having that local lived experience feed into what's happening, what should be happening, what the changes are and being observed. So did that have any opportunity with Extreme E to kind of further that? And I guess the question that I have is, you know, what brought you to Extreme E to work with the Science Advisory Panel?
Yeah, thank you. Absolutely did. I really see Extreme E as an awesome opportunity to share some ideas, some understanding, and some thoughts with a really different audience, and to get their perspective on what the solutions and needs are. Okay, I'm a scientist and I am fortunate enough to every day think about the ocean, but that doesn't need to say that I alone and my colleagues will come up with the right solutions. We need to listen to each other and do so in a really respectful and inclusive way. And I kind of see myself as a facilitator, both in my own research and my role really in Extreme E as a science advisor. I'm really here to look at what great work is being done, especially in the countries where the races are being conducted, to highlight and promote the voices of the local scientists and communities who every day are experiencing the consequences of climate change, and who can also show some really concrete examples that are important for the rest of us to be cognizant about. You know, climate change is a global issue, but that doesn't mean that it's an equal issue. And the inequalities that are present across the globe are, I would say, increasing with climate change. So those that were suffering before are having to deal with some of the consequences of climate change much more than those that were privileged. And I think, you know, this is something that we have to acknowledge, understand, and then act to correct. And I think with Extreme E and this worldwide audience, we really have this opportunity to provide both a visualization of the challenges But also, where are those opportunities? Where is the cutting edge technology? Where are the local community driven changes that can be made? And what can we critically, what can we learn from each other?
Yeah, that's interesting where you mention the responsibility of the privileged and also that disproportionate impact on developing countries. So where would you see the responsibility of G7 summits and, of course, the upcoming COP26 forum for addressing some of those imbalances?
Yeah, I think with COP26, we have an opportunity as global citizens and as leaders to understand that our oceans, our climate, our well-being, and indeed, let's put no finer point on it, the existence of humans in the way that we understand now is really reliant on. And we cannot finger point and say they need to do something. We all need to do something, but we also really need to step up to the plate. Mm. Need to think about who are those drivers of pollution now and in the past, acknowledge where that's come from, and make concrete commitments and critically action plans to make sure that we are addressing the actions that are needed. Because it's very easy for these things to be talking shops. And we get really happy with ourselves, pat ourselves on the back and go, that's really nice. I wrote another paper. Thank you very much. That's my job done. But that piece of paper itself is not going to change the trajectory that we're on globally. And as we said before, those that have seen so many more inequalities across the globe are those that are trying to deal with some of these really critical changes right now. And I think we all need to be mindful of that and understand each of us can make changes, but actually some of us should be making many, many more changes.
This is the 3Ds. How can we find out more about your research more about ocean health and climate change? Where can we read more of what you've done?
Well, thank you for that question. So I guess I've spoken a little bit throughout the podcast about what I've done. But of course, this only covers a really tiny proportion and absolutely doesn't do justice to my wonderful colleagues who are present from all across the globe. And that's one thing that I am grateful for, is the way that we can come together, and we're so much more powerful when we do act in really positive teams. So the work that I do is all co-created and co-designed with nationals in the countries that I work. And at the moment, our focus is Indian Ocean regions. So this means that I'm fortunate enough to develop research ideas with scientists from the countries that border the Indian Ocean, and especially the Western Indian Ocean region. And often these questions are those that answer real and immediate challenges in that region. I'm principal scientist for a UK NGO called Necton, and their work wholly focuses on amplifying the ocean and the people in and around its shores. So really making sure that both we have a platform to visualize the awesomeness of the ocean and to share that it's not all doom and gloom, not all coral reefs are yet dead, and we do have hope. But also, what do we know about the ocean and what can we learn from each other? So making sure that we listen and we talk with that mutual respect and inclusivity. And of course, that's a really important part of the UN Ocean Decade, which we've just started. So one of the things I'm doing right now is I work on expeditions to explore deeper reefs in the region of the Western Indian Ocean. Back in 2019, I conducted an expedition with Seychelles scientists to explore their outer islands. And we're just working up data with them now, which is incredibly exciting. Just before you and I were talking today, I was talking to stakeholders in Comores on a similar project looking at their deeper reefs. So it's going on, it's out there. And interestingly, the big message that was given at that meeting was, we want to do more. We know a little bit, we want so much more so that we can better manage our oceans. And that's an incredibly powerful message to have coming back at these, you know, reporting meetings. So as we move forward, of course, we try and understand and document the patterns of life in these deeper reefs. And when I talk about deeper reefs, I'm thinking those that are beyond scuba diving depth. So between sort of 30 meters and about 500 meters. Beautiful colors, amazing types of life. But, you know, until the last five, maybe 10 years, they weren't explored so much. But they're incredibly valuable to us and potentially can act as refugia for some of the organisms that currently live in the shallow waters, because there's fewer threats as we go a bit deeper. So important for us to understand, understanding the patterns, but critically, I think, to understand why we have the patterns where we do. So can we predict where we might see life? And can we predict what we're going to see in the future? You know, are the generations to come going to be seeing the same types of organisms? And the reason for this type of work is so that we can understand how best to manage the ocean, to make sure that areas that will or are likely to last into the future are really well protected as those sources to regenerate the ocean roundabout. And I think, you know, this last expedition with Seychelles was so important. They are really a true leader when it comes to protecting the ocean. And it was an absolute privilege to work with them. They have now designated over 30% of their ocean for protection.
Wow.
And I think I would just like to really reiterate that it's actually only working together, listening to each other, hearing each other, understanding each other, that we can really get behind the needs and the actions that collectively we need to put into place.
That's an absolutely fantastic message to end on. Dr. Lucy Whittle, thank you so much for your time today. It's been insightful, fascinating, and really enjoyable talking to you today. So thank you so much for your time.
No problem. My complete pleasure.